Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is April 10th, 2016, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Groove is in the Heart Pathway. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Salim Rezaei. And Salim is an associate clinical professor of emergency medicine and internal medicine at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, Texas, and also the creator and founder of Rebel EM. Welcome back to the SGEM, Salim.
Ken, thank you for having me on for another episode. I can't tell you how pumped up I get for these things. You always help me keep that critical eye on all the research that I'm reading. So thank you so much.
Well, you're too kind. But you know what? You're more than just a rebel. You also work closely with Rob Rogers on that amazing teaching course.
I got to tell you, Ken, that has been just a game changer for me in medical education. I mean, we talk about all sorts of things. You were there in New York with me. We talk about slide design, how to give a great talk, all kinds of innovations in medical education, even like the podcast that we're doing here to help cut down knowledge translation. I recently came across a quote by William Arthur Ward that I think summarizes what Rob and I are trying to do with the teaching course. And it goes like this: the mediocre teacher tells, the good teacher explains, the superior teacher demonstrates, the great teacher inspires. And that is exactly what we're trying to do with the course. We're trying to inspire people that are passionate about medical education, but not just the people who are attending the course, but also people who are teaching at the course. It's just an extravaganza for anybody who's been there, and we hope to get more people. If they want to hear more about it or read more about it, come check out our website at flippingmeded.com.
Okay, Salim, let's get this episode of the SGEM kick-started with a case.
So I think this is probably a case that will be near and dear to many of our hearts. It's a 40-year-old man who arrives in the emergency department via EMS complaining of substernal chest pain. It's been there for the last 3 days, and he's really had no relief at any point. He denies shortness of breath, radiation of his pain, nausea, vomiting, diaphoresis, or any sort of palpitations. He also states he has no past medical history, and he does not smoke, but states his father died of an MI at the age of 70, which is why he even called the ambulance to begin with, because he was worried that maybe he was having a heart attack. He says he runs 4 times a week without any difficulty, has some increased stress at his workplace, and in your evaluation of this patient in the emergency department, you get an EKG that shows normal sinus rhythm without any other sort of abnormalities, and cardiac troponin testing, which is negative, both at arrival and at 3 hours after his arrival. So you go to speak to your patient about objective provocative testing. And I guess what this episode is going to be about is, what's our conversation exactly going to be with this patient at this point?
All right. Before we have that conversation, let's give people some background information about the millions. And what I mean by millions is the 8 to 10 million patients complaining of chest pain coming to the emergency department in the United States annually.
Yeah, and their chest pain definitely gives most of us chest pain, because we just don't want to be sued. But in the U.S., we have a very, very, very liberal testing strategy in order to avoid missing acute coronary syndrome with patients with chest pain because of that fear of being sued.
Yeah, you seem to have a culture for 0% miss rate.
Yeah, and that results in over 50% of ED patients with acute chest pain receiving serial cardiac biomarkers, stress testing, and or cardiac angiography at an estimated cost of $10 to $13 billion annually. And yet, less than 10% of those patients actually get diagnosed with acute coronary syndrome.
That's billions. Yes, billions with a B, Salim.
Yeah, and let's add further angst to emergency department providers. The American College of Cardiology American Heart Association recommends that chest pain patients with concern for acute coronary syndrome, they should receive serial cardiac markers followed by some sort of provocative objective cardiac testing.
Yeah, and using this strategy among the low-risk chest pain population unnecessarily uses resources on those least likely to benefit.
Look, I'm not a smart man, Ken, but let's be honest. Low-risk patients, they're low risk.
Yeah, low-risk chest patients have an ACS rate of less than 2%, and provocative objective cardiac testing is associated with a significant amount of downstream testing, like cardiac catheterization, due to false positive tests. And these false positive tests expose these patients to potential harms from the testing and from the treatment.
So can anything be done about this overdiagnosis and overtreatment?
Well, in the past, Salim, various researchers have looked at the value of chest pain characteristics to predict ACS, and unfortunately, none of these individual elements have ever been shown to have a positive likelihood ratio of greater than 10 or a negative likelihood ratio of less than 0.1 to help us rule out or rule in ACS.
Yeah, but what about cardiac risk factors? That's what everyone seems to be talking about.
You mean like the Framingham criteria? They predict future risk, but don't help us at deciding in the emergency department whether or not the patient is having ACS today.
But what about if we combine various aspects like risk factors, history, physical, labs, EKG findings into a score like, I don't know, Timmy score or Gray score?
Yeah, but the problem with Timmy and Gray scores is they were not designed to assess whether patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain are due to ACS. They were designed to risk stratify patients once the diagnosis of ACS had already been made.
But I got some good news for you, Ken, and for the listeners. Now, only now, do we have a score developed in the emergency department to help us risk stratify patients who present to the emergency department with chest pain into who will have major adverse cardiac events, or we'll just say MACE from now on, in the next 6 weeks and will not have a MACE event.
This new score is called the HEART score. Salim, can you please explain what the 5 different elements of the HEART score are?
Yes, our inner Cori Slovis, 5 things: history, EKG, age, risk factors, and troponin. Each one of those gets divided into 3 different categories. You get 0, 1, or 2 points. You add those all up, and you basically break your patients into 3 groups. 0 to 3 being low risk, 4 to 6 being intermediate risk, and 7 to 10 being high risk.
So I'll put up a table in the blog for the HEART score so people can go and review that in detail. But what's the data so far on the HEART score?
It's actually pretty good. So the data on the HEART score has been examined in over 13,000 patients and demonstrated a high negative predictive value for major adverse cardiac events at 6 weeks, exceeding 98%. But many people, they're not okay with a 2% risk. That's still too high for them.
So what's the clinical question then?
So does the HEART pathway help us identify emergency department patients with acute chest pain who are safe for early discharge without objective cardiac testing?
And what's the reference to try to answer this clinical question?
Is Mailer, Essay et al., the HEART pathway randomized trial identifying emergency department patients with acute chest pain for early discharge, Circulation Cardiovascular Quality Outcomes, 2015.
There have been a number of papers published already on the HEART score, Salim. Why did you pick this paper to review?
Yeah, so there's really 2 big reasons. So number one is that there's just not been a lot of randomized clinical trials. A lot of the trials have been looking at secondary data or observational. This is actually a randomized clinical trial looking at the HEART score versus usual care. And then the second issue is that most of the HEART score trials have been done out of the Netherlands and Europe, but this one's actually done in a U.S. population.
Oh, that's a nice way to lead us into the PICO, because that P stands for population. So what was the population in this study?
Right. So it was patients greater than or equal to 21 years of age presenting with symptoms suggestive of ACS that providers ordered EKGs and troponins on.
And so they excluded STEMI patients, patients with hypotension, life expectancy less than a year, and non-cardiac, medical, surgical, or psychiatric illnesses requiring an admission. What was the intervention that they used?
So we'll call it the HEART pathway, but just so that the listeners know, it's a combination of the HEART score applied with a 0 and 3 hour cardiac troponin test.
And we'll put up a flow sheet, a diagram of what that HEART pathway involved. What did they compare it to?
Usual care, which is the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association guidelines, serial cardiac biomarkers, and objective cardiac testing before discharge.
And so when they say objective testing, objective cardiac testing was a stress test or angiography. What was their primary outcome?
Rate of objective cardiac testing within 30 days of presentation.
And so that was any stress test modality, coronary computer tomography angiography, or invasive coronary angioplasty. What was their secondary outcomes?
Index length of stay, early discharge, which they defined as discharge from the emergency department without objective cardiac testing, and major adverse cardiac events, which was defined as all-cause mortality, myocardial infarction, or coronary revascularization at 30 days.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, the heart pathway reduces objective cardiac testing during 30 days, shortens length of stay, and increases early discharges. These important efficiency gains occurred without any patients identified for early discharge suffering a MACE at 30 days. End of quote. All right, let's go through the 11 quality checklists for randomized clinical trials. Question number one, Salim. The study populations included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes, it did. Patients were greater than or equal to 21 years of age, presenting in the ED with symptoms suggestive of acute coronary syndrome.
Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes, they were. Patients were randomized into one of two treatment arms with equal probability using a random permuted block randomization.
And was the randomization process concealed?
Yes, study investigators and staff were blinded to the randomization sequence.
Question number four, the patients, were they analyzed into the groups which they were randomized?
Yes, they were.
The study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
So no, there was actually set enrollment hours. They actually enrolled 6 days a week, excluding Saturdays, at 80 hours per week.
And the patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, they were.
And all the participants, the patients, the clinicians, the outcome assessors, were they unaware of group allocation?
So the answer is no on this one, because it's going to be impossible to blind clinicians to usual care versus heart pathway.
All right, question number eight. All groups, were they treated equally except for the intervention?
It's unclear. So there wasn't really documentation of who got aspirin, who got oxygen, nitroglycerin, other kind of medications that you would get pre-hospital or at presentation.
How about their follow-up? Was it complete?
So yes, assessment for 30-day events was completed on 96% of study participants.
All patient important outcomes, do you think they were considered?
Yes, I do.
And the final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
It's unclear. Study was powered to detect a 15% reduction in objective cardiac testing within 30 days with a 90% power with an expected loss to follow-up of 10%. But in this study, there was only a 12% reduction in objective cardiac testing at 30 days.
All right, so let's go through some of those results in more detail. The key results. And that is, they enrolled 282 patients into the study with 141 into each group. The mean age of the patients was about 53 years of age, with 57% being women. And the overall MACE rate was 6%, or 17 out of the 282.
So of the 141 patients randomized into the heart pathway, there was close to a 50-50 split between patients stratified as low risk, 47%, and those stratified as high risk, 53%.
And we should mention there was some significant non-adherence to the heart pathway. 29% of low-risk patients and 13% of high-risk patients didn't follow the strict protocol of the heart pathway. Okay, let's get to that primary outcome, though, that objective cardiac testing within 30 days. What did they find?
So the heart pathway was 56.7% versus usual care, which was 68.8%.
All right, so let me see if I can do that math in my head. So that was an absolute testing reduction of 12.1%, giving you an NNT of 8. How about their secondary outcome, the early discharge rate?
Right, heart pathway was 39.7%, usual care 18.4%.
All right, so that was an absolute early discharge increase of 21.3%. How about that median length of stay? What happened with that?
No surprise here. Heart pathway, 9.9 hours versus usual care, 21.9 hours.
And that MACE event, what about those?
So zero patients, I'm going to say that again, zero patients identified as low risk by heart pathway had an index or non-index MACE.
Well, now it's time for the talk nerdy section. And we have a special treat for the SJammers out there. We reached out to the lead author, Dr. Simon Mahler from Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We wanted to get a better understanding of his paper. Unfortunately, Salim could not join us for this part of the recording, but welcome to the SJam, Simon.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for all the hard work you put into publishing this study on the heart pathway. It's really easy to be critical of other work, but unless you're actively doing research, you may not appreciate the determination and passion that it takes to go from conception to publication. So well done, Simon.
Thank you. Ken, you're right. Actually, a lot of work went into this study. Just to give you a little bit of the backstory, I actually started writing the grant for this study back in 2011, at the end of 2011. And we were fortunate to get funded by the American Heart Association in the summer of 2012. We started enrollment in the fall of that year and ended enrollment in early 2014. So by the time we analyzed our data, submitted our manuscript, went back and forth with the journal, we finally had a published article by March of 2015. So it really was a long haul, and that speaks to the issue that you tackle with the time from knowledge translation.
It sure does. It does take a long time for that knowledge to translate. So there were five things I wanted to go through with you about your study. And the first thing was the setting. This was an RCT, which makes it a superior design to the previous observational trials, and it was done on a US population rather than a European population, and so it's more applicable to North Americans. However, the study was conducted at a single center, and that limits the generalizability to other community settings.
This is true. It is a small single center study, and that does limit generalizability. However, there are some important reasons why we designed it this way. This study was radically different from the previous studies using accelerated diagnostic pathways or chest pain decision aids. Almost all of the prior studies on ADPs or accelerated diagnostic pathways or protocols were retrospective or observational, as you mentioned. And this was the first and remains the only RCT in which patients were actually discharged from the ED based on an EDP without having a rapid stress testing option. The only other similar RCT was completed by Martin Than in New Zealand, and they randomized patients to the ADAPT protocol in usual care, also at a single center. But all of the patients that they identified as low risk still received stress testing within 72 hours. So we sent our patients home without plans for rapid outpatient stress testing. And so when you do something that's so different than the norm, you need to start smaller. You don't start with the definitive study. So this was intended to be a step towards demonstrating that we can safely identify a low-risk group of patients for early discharge.
Well, the second thing we wanted to talk about was the sample size. And the methods say the study was powered to detect a 15% reduction in objective cardiac testing within 30 days with a 90% power at the 5% two-sided level of significance with an expected loss follow-up rate of 10%. Now, I couldn't find in the manuscript itself how many people you needed to recruit, but you did enroll 282 people.
Right. Thanks for bringing this up. I think the source of confusion is that our study was powered to detect a 15% difference at an 80% power, but the article states that we used a 90% power. So this was an oversight on our part when we wrote up the manuscript. But fortunately, this is a minor oversight because the study was clearly adequately powered. So to get into some of the specifics of our power calculation, and this was done a priori, so before we started doing any of the study, we considered some of our previous studies, and we had seen in our study of the MIDAS trial that we were able to decrease testing by a little over 20%. But this was a retrospective study. It was actually a prospective study, but we did a secondary analysis retrospectively. So we knew that in real clinical use, we were not going to have 100% adherence, that we were going to that non-adherence was definitely going to eat into our effect. So we felt like we were choosing a conservative effect size of 15% for a reduction in our objective cardiac testing rate. So we expected a rate of 83% and for that to go down to about 68%. So using those percentages with an 80% power and a 5% two-sided alpha, we actually get to a sample size calculation of 127 patients per group. But that isn't the final number because you have to factor in withdrawals and the number of patients that might be lost to follow-up, which we estimated at 10%. So actually, to get our final sample size calculation, you take that 127 and you divide it by 90%, which gets you to that 141 patients per group. So I hope that clarifies our sample size calculation.
No, that really does, because I was a bit confused there when I read the numbers and I was trying to plug it into a power calculation using the 90%, and I just couldn't get the right answer. But using 80% certainly does, and I can see that your study was properly powered, at least for the enrollment that you had with 141 in each arm. Now, you do report a 12% absolute difference for the primary outcome of objective testing in the next 30 days. And I have to admit, though, I was a little skeptical when I saw these numbers for a couple of reasons. The first is, like you said, you powered the study to find a 15% difference, which you considered clinically significant a priori, yet you only found a 12% effect size. Doesn't that leave your study just a little short of the mark?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, if you recall, what power does is it protects your study from making a type 2 error, which is having a falsely negative study. So if you do a study and the truth in the universe is that you have a real difference between the two groups, but your study shows that you don't find a difference, then you have a type 2 error and your study is underpowered. But the results of our primary outcome were statistically significant. So by definition, our study was adequately powered to detect a real difference. I think what is confusing here is that we powered for 15% but found a 12% difference. But this 12% difference is statistically significant and still represents a clinically meaningful difference. So when we set out to find 15%, that's what we thought we were going to find as a conservative estimate. It turns out that we were not quite conservative enough, but we still found a 12% difference. And I think it's hard to argue that a 12% reduction in stress testing isn't clinically meaningful.
Well, a 12% absolute reduction in objective testing may be very important to both the patient and the healthcare system. But when you put the p-value at the end of it, that doesn't tell us everything. It doesn't tell us the precision of the point estimate. And for that, we need a 95% confidence interval. Can you provide those?
Sure, sure. Yeah, the 95% confidence interval around that 12.1% was 7.6% to 18.6%. So that's a pretty wide interval, but it's important to keep in mind that when you have a smaller study like ours, you are going to see wide confidence intervals.
Well, the final thing I wanted to talk about power was that of your secondary outcome. And specifically, you make it very clear that this study was not powered to detect a difference in MACE.
Yes, that's definitely true. You would need thousands of patients to detect a small difference in MACE rates.
All right, so the third thing I wanted to go through was non-adherence. You left things open in both arms to provide care at the discretion of the provider. In other words, you did not mandate the care by the protocol. Why did you make that choice?
Ken, this is a really important question. The heart pathway and other accelerated diagnostic pathways are designed to aid clinical decisions, not to replace clinical judgment. And no tool is ever going to be perfect. So in the real world, clinicians need to be able to have the freedom to make decisions. So we wanted to test the heart pathway consistent with the way it was going to be used in the real world and really the way in which accelerated diagnostic pathways are intended to be used.
Well, the non-adherence to the heart pathway occurred in 29% of the low-risk patients and 13% of the high-risk patients. What would the results have been if there was perfect adherence to the heart pathway?
Kenya, actually, we just recently published a secondary analysis looking specifically at the non-adherence. This was in Academic Emergency Medicine in January of this year. And so if adherence were perfect, we would have increased our early discharge rate to 47%. Interestingly, among all the low-risk patients that were non-adherently kept in the hospital and received stress testing, none of them had an adverse event. So keeping these patients in the hospital didn't result in any quote-unquote saves. In fact, we actually had two of these patients receive false positive stress tests. And I think this is actually one of the important messages that to take away from this analysis on non-adherence, that if you stress test patients with a really low pretest probability for disease, you're actually more likely to have a false positive than you are to have a true positive. And that those false positives can then lead to further and invasive testing. So I think that was a really important thing that came out of that sub-study.
So if physicians had strictly followed that heart pathway, almost half of the patients could have been discharged home without any objective testing being done prior to the emergency department discharge. Now, do you think that this non-adherence really represents a more accurate determination of, you know, the real world practice of using clinical decision instruments?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. But I do think adherence can be improved. And for example, most of our non-adherence was actually early on in our study. And as our providers became more accustomed to using the heart pathway, the non-adherence seemed to decrease. And so I definitely think there are ways that adherence can be improved. But there's always going to be some non-adherence. And like I mentioned before, I think some of that is with good reason. We still have to remember that we're clinicians and we need to make judgments. And this is not going to replace clinical judgment.
Well, that's a nice lead-in to the next issue. And this was that not all low-risk heart score patients are necessarily low-risk. It is possible to have an elevated troponin and all other aspects of the heart score be zero. And by definition, this would be deemed a low-risk patient. And similarly, significant ST depressions alone would be considered low-risk. However, I think there are some physicians out there that would be uncomfortable stratifying these patients as low-risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should be. A patient with a positive troponin or an ischemic EKG should not be categorized as low risk. In fact, this is one of the differences, one of the main differences between the heart score and the heart pathway. These are, although people think of them synonymously, they're not the same. One of the problems, as you mentioned, with the heart score is the fact that you can have a positive troponin and still be considered low risk. That's not the case in the heart pathway. With the heart pathway, you have to have both a score of 0 to 3 based on the heart score and a negative troponin on arrival and a negative troponin within 3 hours. In fact, we've actually implemented the heart pathway within Wake Forest Health System. We've actually built it into our, fully integrated it into our electronic medical record. And the way that we have operationalized the heart pathway is you are not considered low risk if you have an ischemic EKG, if you have any positive troponin, and if you have known coronary disease. We also don't ask our providers to fill out a heart pathway assessment on those patients, because the vast, vast majority of those patients are not patients that are appropriate for early discharge. So there's some nuances in the way that the heart pathway is used and the heart score.
Well, clinical decision aids are to help us give structure to risk stratify, but it's that art of medicine, which you've referred to before, is to use our clinical judgment. And these clinical decision instruments are just tools. They're not rules. And we need to know how to use these tools to guide our care for individual patient needs.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
Again, that's a nice way to lead us into the fifth and final point, and that's about shared decision making. Evidence-based medicine is not just about the literature. Evidence-based medicine is our clinical judgment, relevant scientific evidence, and patients' values and preferences. And it was Dr. Sackett who defined evidence-based medicine as, quote, the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of the current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients. And the only thing I would have added to that quote is it's for making shared decisions about the care of individual patients. And I noted that the issue of patient values and preferences was not discussed in this paper, Simon, but it represents an important component of chest pain evaluations and dispositions.
Yeah, I think that shared decision-making definitely has an important role in chest pain care, and I'm a real fan of the work that Eric Hess has done with the chest pain choice. However, I don't think that a shared decision is necessary for patients with less than a 1% risk of MACE at 30 days. So if a patient really wants to stay, if they're low risk by the heart pathway, they really want to stay, they want to get stress test, you're actually not doing them a favor by admitting them or placing them in the observation unit. Their risk of actually having a false positive stress test or other nosocomial event is actually higher than the risk of sending them home. So I think the place for shared decision making is not with those very ultra low risk patients. It's actually in the patients that are at moderate risk. So where I tend to use the shared decisions, and I encourage our residents and other and faculty members to use shared decisions, is actually with the patients that have heart scores of 4s and 5s. Yeah, these are the patients sort of with the intermediate or moderate risk. And these are patients, as long as they have non-ischemic EKGs and 2 negative troponins, you can have a shared decision with them about whether or not they want further evaluation either in the hospital setting or as an outpatient.
That's great. Thanks for talking about that and showing us how shared decision making could be used with the heart pathway. Those are all the questions I had for you for the Talk Nerdy section. Thanks very much, Simon, for helping us understand your paper better.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking nerdy.
Well, it's something I like to do on a weekly basis. Well, is there anything else you wanted to talk about, Simon, that you think it's important for the SJAM listeners to know about?
Yeah, thank you for asking me. So most of the discussion we've had today and some of my previous discussions about this manuscript have focused in on the primary endpoint of objective cardiac testing at 30 days. However, I actually think that it's much more interesting, the findings with our secondary endpoints, and in particular, the difference that we saw in early discharge rate. We were able to increase early discharges by over 20%, and in relative terms, that actually doubled the rate of early discharge compared to usual care. So we're talking about a huge difference there. Also, if you look at that length of stay that we report, our median reduction in length of stay between our two groups, not between low risk and high risk, between groups was 12 hours. That's a half a day decrease in length of stay. So these are huge efficiency gains. And these big reductions in healthcare utilization occurred without any low-risk patients suffering adverse events or bouncing back to the ED for chest pain. And the last thing I want to say is that we have developed a free Heart Pathway app. So if you have an iPhone, you can go to the App Store and download this completely free of charge and experience how at Wake Forest we're using the Heart Pathway.
Oh, what a nice foamy gift to give out to everyone. Simon, I want to thank you for helping us cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year by coming on the SJEM today.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
All right, so now we're going to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SJEM's conclusions. And we differ a little bit from what the authors have said, because we think that using the heart pathway in chest pain patients presenting to the emergency department with suspicion of ACS has the potential to decrease objective cardiac testing and increase early discharge rates and cut median length of stay. However, based on this one study alone, it is unclear if it truly results in a zero MACE rate at 30 days. But Salim, can you give us a bottom line?
The heart pathway appears to have the potential to safely decrease objective cardiac testing, increase early discharge rates, and cut median length of stay in low-risk chest pain patients presenting to the emergency department with suspicion of ACS.
All right, so how are you going to resolve this case that you presented?
So you present the information to the patient, letting him know that his ECG does not have any ischemic abnormalities. He's considered a low-risk patient based on his heart score, and troponin testing at 0 and 3 hours were both negative. At this point, you offer him some outpatient follow-up with his primary care physician versus some type of objective provocative testing using a shared decision-making strategy. The patient states, like we presented at the beginning, that the reason he came to the ED is he just wanted to make sure he wasn't having a heart attack like his father, and actually feels comfortable following up with his primary care physician as an outpatient and discharged home.
So how are you going to take this one study? How are you going to take this information and apply it clinically?
Yeah, and that's a tough thing to do because evaluation of low-risk chest pain, it doesn't live in a bubble of this one study. Even though the study was not powered to detect patient-oriented outcomes, there have been many studies looking at the use of the heart score in the evaluation of chest pain, and the sum of these studies shows that we can do an amazingly good job in low-risk chest pain patients with a 30-day MACE rate of less than 2%.
So how are you going to take this information to the bedside and explain it to the patient?
At this point in your workup, with a low-risk heart score, non-ischemic EKG, and negative 0 and 3 hour cardiac troponins, for every 100 patients who come to the ED with chest pain, 1 in 100 will have either a heart attack or pre-heart attack diagnosis in the next 30 days. We can offer you one of two choices. One, we can keep you in the hospital to do some type of stress testing, or we can have you follow up with your primary care physician and continue following up this chest pain as an outpatient.
I like how you brought in that shared decision-making in with the patient. All right, so for the Keener contest, there was no Keener contest last week because we did an SJEM Extra about the metrics study. And if you have not entered the metrics, please help us make FOMED even better. What's the question this week, Salim?
Yeah, so since we're talking about the heart score, I thought we'd go with something simple. What year was the heart score first introduced?
Oh, a great knowledge translation question. Hint, it was not 17 years. But if you know the year when the heart score was first published, send me your answer, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, I just want to give people a quick conference update. The Tom Steele Symposium, we are taking the SGEM on the road and going to be given a full day of EBM, knowledge translation, social media, myth busting, critical appraisal, and the best of the SGEM. This will be in Springfield, Missouri, May 6th, and the ranting PEDS EM superhero Anthony Crockle will be there. And at the other end of the age spectrum, we'll have that geriatric EM guru Chris Carpenter. He'll be joining us and giving the presentations. Also, there, of course, is the Society of Academic Emergency Medicine in May 10th to 13th in New Orleans. I'll be there hanging out with the new editor-in-chief of the journal, Jeff Klein.
Also, the Social Media and Critical Care Conference, or SMAC, is coming up in Dublin, Ireland on June 13th through the 16th.
And just before that, we'll have the CAPE, the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians, meeting in beautiful Quebec City, June 4th to 8th. Bat Doc will be there, and I will be recording a few more Talk Nerdy to Me videos. Well, thanks again for coming back on the SGEM, Salim. It's always great to put the rebel together with a skeptic to create some foamy goodness.
Ken, thank you for always looking out for me. Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you for just being you. And thank you for everything you're doing with the SGEM to help cut down knowledge translation and help all of us improve patient care.
Well, I don't think any of us in the FOMED world would be doing it if we just didn't love the work. So, Salim, give us the SGEM tagline, but in your best rebel Billy Idol impersonation.
I don't have any type of British accent in me. I'll give you a Texan accent. How about that?
That sounds great.
All right. Remember to be skeptical of anything you hear, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.